Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Can't be said enough. Homage to the Kruba Ajahns, our great Ajahns of the past. Homage to Lungpo Cha, Lungpo Liam. It's like a precious jewel of the Sangha. Homage to Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Pasano, and our other great teachers. Just recognizing the teachings they've given us and the endless gifts. Today is Christmas, a day of giving gifts, and they don't wait for Christmas, they just give gifts every day. So, Ajahn Pasano, with a heart like solid gold, just giving, giving, giving more and more. So, lifting up that idea of gratitude and reverence for teachers, and recognizing what we have, what we've been given. So, most of us come to practice based on something we've read, something we've heard, or something has given rise to faith in us. So we come to the practice, the Dhamma practice. Or for those of us who have left the home life, then something has stirred us deep inside, and we've been moved to renounce. Something has stirred us to the point that we feel like there's enough faith in the awakening of the Buddha, or enough faith in the Dhamma, enough faith that the realization of Nibbana is possible, that has stirred us enough to want to give up everything and endure all sorts of privations in order to progress along the path, to give up our life, really our personal preferences, our and coming into the monastic form, relinquishing all sorts of desires, perhaps not relinquishing all desire right off the bat, but just entering into the form, just the Padimokkha, the precepts, just that is a cuts out a whole big part of the desire realm. There may be things we can get involved in, distractions. They're all pretty innocent if we're in the monastic form. So we really, just entering into the form, we let go of all sorts of desires and attachments right off the bat. Sometimes it's difficult to recognize that. The mind still thinks according to its old tracks, its old habits, but it's good to recognize that we have already cut out a big part of the desire realm. The longer we stick with it, the longer we commit, the better chance we have at getting closer to Nibbana. So if we don't have the spiritual perfections or qualities to be able to realize it in this lifetime, then we can even have that sense of commitment where at least we can get closer. So we hear a teaching or read something, something stirs us, and what is that? What is that that makes us act, makes us move towards the Dhamma? I remember before coming to the monastery, just building up a lot of faith. So listening to talks of His Holiness the Dalai Lama online and just reading a lot of books, mostly Tibetan Buddhism, but I also had started reading Ajahn Chah books. I read A Still Forest Pool, and then I started looking up online teachings of more teachings of Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, but also still listening to a lot of talks and reading a lot of books in Tibetan Buddhism. I was also reading Krishnamurti, so there's this whole idea of Nibbana is the unconditioned, or the Amata Dhamma, like the deathless Dhamma, and reading these teachings, having a lot of faith coming up, and so much faith, it was starting to turn into like a conviction, so I was getting my mind around this possibility of ordination or entering a monastery. And remember one day talking to my mom about some of these things I was reading, and she was kind of doubtful as to what I was getting into. And I just said, "Well, Mom, I can prove that the unconditioned exists." And she said, "Okay, well, prove it." And then I thought for a second that actually I can't. But that was just the faith talking. The energy. But still there's this almost like following a scent of virtue. So what is that? What is that in us that says it's true? That, what is that conviction? Why is it any different than any other belief? So we read a teaching of Ajahn Chah that suffering can come to an end if we practice. Why do we believe that? Meiji Gao talked about suffering as like the long road of suffering. And once we make progress along the path, then we start to see in the distance the end of the long road of suffering starts to come into view. So there's this possibility of an end to suffering. So the long road of just dissatisfaction, torment, even misery. Just so much suffering. Just in general, so many unhappy people in the world, so much suffering, even if we don't have live in Somalia or some place where there's terrible conflict happening. Even if we have all the comforts and a fairly easygoing life, still that nagging unhappiness or dissatisfaction. And just for so long, In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha answers a question of a monk. Just some no-name bhikkhu comes to the Buddha and says, like, "Samsara, this word samsara, what is meant by that?" And the Buddha just says, "Samsara is long, bhikkhu. Samsara is long." So there's this sense of like the long road of suffering, just the wandering on. So how much is enough? How much suffering is enough before we turn our mind back to Nibbana? So just contemplating that. And we have to actually do something about it. So just doing nothing isn't the path. So we have to do something. So this is called kamma, or action. And we call it kamatana, or like the basis of work, basis of action. So there's all these different kamatana. And there's the anurakana kamatana. So there's these protective meditations or protective practices that we do. So there's death contemplation. There's the metta practice. There's the asubha practice, or the cultivation of the contemplation of unattractive. And there's the Buddha Nusati, which is the recollection of the Buddha. So the Buddha said if we keep these four contemplations or these four practices alive, then we protect ourselves from worldly influences, worldly energies that are always trying to come into the heart. So it's like the death contemplation, just even taking that one, that's marana nusati. Taking the death contemplation, that just that is enough to cut away thoughts of the past and the future. Like Lokpor Cha saying, like a samana has no future, like a religious seeker has no future. It's a ordaining into the monastic form is a different paradigm than having a career. So we might think of ourselves as career monks, like this is my uniform, this is my career, but it's not quite to be thought of that way. Because normally if thinking about the future, it's like, okay, I want to graduate from high school, I'm going to go to college, have a career, make a lot of money, hopefully, get married, have a bunch of kids, then retire, then die. Okay, that's it. Well, even if you think that way, that's death contemplation too, because it ends in death. It always ends in death. No matter what we do, whether we practice or not, that's the inevitable end. So the death contemplation has two parts. One is that death is inevitable. The second part is that we have no idea when it's going to happen. So there's a certainty mixed with an uncertainty there. We can be certain that it's going to happen. You know, sometimes you might hear, like, especially in some New Age beliefs, like, but it's just around the corner, science. Was about to discover, like, we'll be able to live 1,000 years. And just, it's just not going to happen. I'll be the one to live to be 200. But even then, it still has to end. So, certainty mixed with uncertainty. There's the certainty of death and the uncertainty of when it's going to happen. It reminds me of something Ajahn Dunn said when he was here. Like he said, it was really, he started talking high Dhamma. He gave a really long Dhamma talk when he was here. And one thing he said was, when there's knowing and there's not knowing. So these two things are very important, because the knowing is, it's something which is ever present, so you can always know. But then there's the not knowing what's actually going to happen. And when the knowing and the not knowing become one, then that's Nibbana. So I thought that was really interesting. So death contemplation, and this is, we don't want it to become something which is like morbid and depressing. So if that's the result, then one can ease off of it a little bit. I was trying to get really intense with the death contemplation at Dao Dam in 2006. I just remember just getting really intense about the practice and doing almost completely just doing death contemplation, just on the walking meditation path. The way I was doing it was visualizing a black circle behind my head, which was death. And that could just like move into my head, and then I would be dead anytime. And just doing that for hours on end. And it actually got a bit too intense, and I had to stop. It was kind of got like, fear started coming up. It started like believing that maybe I would just like drop dead any second. And then the inevitable thoughts like, well, you know, that'd be fine for me, but my parents would be devastated. So like the mind starts proliferating a lot of fear coming up. So then just, okay, just easing off, maybe moving into metta a bit. Metta kamatana. So metta is another protective meditation. So like doing metta kamatana, metta kamatana. This can be like goodwill, friendliness. This can be like held in a lot of different ways. Not just like recitation of, may I be well, may I be happy, may others be well, may others be happy. So it's not just merely that, but it's also a way we hold ourselves and act towards others. And giving rise to good energy, good feelings, good vibrations, metta. I think, yeah, like the practice is just unsustainable without metta. And it's also like if we can't really be serious all the time and sustain ourselves in the holy life, unless maybe you're just a very rare kind of person. So I noticed being around these ajahns in Thailand, senior monks, Lungpur Liam, and other senior Wat Pa Pong ajahns. And they're very serious about their practice and very serious about the training. But at the same time, when you see them with each other, they joke around, they're light. It's not always just like nose to the grindstone. Or like, again, remembering when Ajahn Dunn came to visit, we were getting him set up in the elder's cabin, and I was kind of taken aback. He just started kind of joking around and being really jovial, playful. We were showing him a cabinet where there's tea, and we had some allowables. We had some dark chocolate and ginger there, like actually like quite a bit. And he started like noticing how much there was, and he said, what if I was just to like eat all that chocolate right now? And then you'd probably tell me that was really inappropriate and ask me to leave the monastery. It's been too indulgent. it kind of like cuts through that like ultra serious energy, like, okay, the Krubajans, you really gotta like kind of worried about getting everything just right. That's really nice. Or just being lighthearted and forgiving of others. Just it's like everybody has like blind spots. So for myself, like having a really critical mind, it can be easy to be critical. Actually, it's extremely easy to be critical of others. So anybody who's critical of somebody else, that's like you're like doing what's easy. But it's more difficult and takes real integrity to see other people's good qualities. So that's like doing what's difficult, like actually like noticing people's good qualities, lifting those up, giving importance to those. Things like generosity, that can be like an expression of metta as well. And kind of compassion goes along with that too. Just looking out for each other, or just goodwill, helping each other out, going out of one's way to either give time, give attention to another, or even just as you get more senior, being a foot mat. So Ajahn Chah said, like somebody asked him, what is it like being a like a teacher or a very, very senior monk and having all these disciples, all these lay people, all these monks constantly coming to you? And he said, I'm just like a foot mat. I just lay, it's like a foot mat laying out in front of the monastery and people come and wipe their feet on you and then they go in. So metta, that's higher metta, that's like maha metta. That's like relinquishing oneself for the sake of others. So there's also this practice which is like lifted up, given a lot of importance, made much of in the Thai forest tradition, which is the Asubha Kamatana. And this goes part and parcel with mindfulness of the body, the Asubha Kamatana, but it also, it's pointing to like Asubha as a general concept in terms, Asubha means not beautiful. So like Subha meaning like beautiful. And this is something where when we undertake Dhamma practice, and especially for people who take on the monastic lifestyle, there's a something, there's like a mode that we want to shift the mind out of. So out of the worldly mode into the Dhamma mode. Whereas the worldly mind is always seeking out the sign of the beautiful or the Subhanimitta. So it's always like attracting to different things, whether it's beautiful sights, or it can be even nice sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations. So it's like giving rise to a desire, but the Subhanimitta, or the sign of the beautiful, is like it's a mental object of attraction, and so that's what's like causing us to move in the direction of that desire. And that Subhanimitta, it's always better than the real thing. It's always like, it's like the bait. So it's always like that perfect sign of beauty that we're seeking. And then we move towards that. And of course, nothing ever satisfies that. It's always moving in a new direction, always seeking a new object. But so the asubha kamatana goes directly against that. And so we're prying or like pulling the mind out of the sign of the beautiful and inserting it into the sign of the unbeautiful, and the mind starts to get agitated. It doesn't like it at first, but once we see the results of it, that it's really cooling and settling for the mind, then we start to acquire a taste for it. And again, just like the death contemplation, like it's not a morbid fascination with like, you know, gore or like body parts or something. It's not like that. If the mind starts going, sometimes there's certain personality types where like it'll like the asubha kamatana too much, like get really almost like delight, this kind of delight in like pictures of like just gore, like, but that what we're doing is more just seeing something ordinary, like say our own body, like just seeing that it's like the Buddha said, it's just like a bag with different types of rice and grain in it. So this part has like green gram, this part has mung beans, this part has kidney beans, this part has hill rice, this part has paddy rice, and you just separate it out into different piles. So it's just something that's ordinary. So inside the body, there's the skin, you peel off the skin, then there's the organs, there's the lungs, the liver, the stomach, the intestines. We lay them out, we take a look. That's what's inside the body. That's what gives weight to our body. There's the skeleton, there's the rib cage holding the heart and the lungs. So these things all have weight to them. That's what really just comprises what's sitting here right now. Everybody here has all these organs, stomach, intestines, brain, bones. Even the skin, like if you were to peel off the skin, it's like, it's actually pretty heavy. It's probably like 2 or 3 pounds. If you were just to take all your skin and like bunch it up into a ball, it's probably like 3 pounds of skin. So we take that, like if, as monks, we already cut out a whole like section of like obsession with our own bodies. Like we don't have to worry about our hairstyle. So like, it's like you can get really worried about our hairstyle or our beard style. As monks, it can get more subtle. Like, okay, I'm going to let my sideburns grow like a little, like I'll shave them like an inch down or something like that. You can get a bit more subtle about your hairstyle. But it's not that extreme. We don't have that many options. There's the Buddha's cousin, Nanda, who is a like the stereotypical greed type. As a monk, still he would like paint his lips and use eyeliner. And the Buddha's sort of bemoaning in one of the suttas, like, oh, when will Nanda relinquish his like obsession with his own body? But of course, then Nanda eventually becomes foremost in sense restraint. The story of Nanda is that he was about to become married to the finest Sakyan maiden in the land, and he's about to be married. It's his wedding, and he's invited the Buddha to show up for his wedding, for like a dana. And then the Buddha, after the meal dana, he hands Nanda his bowl. This is just before he's about to be married, and the Buddha just hands him his bowl and doesn't say anything, and then starts walking back to the monastery. And Nanda sort of has the Buddha's bowl. It's like, okay, well, he has to follow him. So he's following the Buddha back to the monastery, and wedding ceremonies, all he's just left it behind. And they get back to the monastery, and the Buddha turns around and says, "Oh, so you want to ordain?" And that Nanda's kind of like, you know, just like, he's the Buddha, so it's just like, how can you say no? And it's like, yes, yeah, I'll ordain. It's just left his wedding ceremony. It's like, so then, of course, some time goes by, and Nanda announces to the other monks, you know, actually, I've been thinking about my fiance quite a bit, and I'm going to disrobe, finish off that wedding ceremony. And so word gets back to the Buddha, and then the Buddha says, okay, well, Nanda, don't disrobe just yet. Let me take you up to this heavenly realm, the Tavatinksa heaven. And if you're desiring your ex-fiance, then let me show you something in the Tavatinksa heaven. So takes him up to Sakka's palace, Tavatinksa heaven. And there's Lord Sakka, king of the Devas, and he's being attended to by 500 dove-footed nymphs. That's the way it's translated. It's, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as pink-footed nymphs, and then Ajahn Jeff translates as dove-footed, whatever that means, and dove-footed nymphs. And the Buddha says, well, Nanda, what is more lovely and beautiful, one of these dove-footed nymphs or your ex-fiancé? And then he says, Lord, my ex-fiancé looks like a castrated, one-eyed, deformed monkey compared to one of these dove-footed nymphs. And the Buddha says, well, you can have these nymphs if you don't disrobe. I guarantee it, if you keep practicing. And so they go back, and Nanda starts practicing one-pointedly, thinking he's going to be reborn in the Tavatinksa heaven. But then he also gains a reputation. He said, Nanda practices for the sake of nymphs. He's not practicing for Nibbana. You know, what is this? So you get a sense of like the Buddha's skillful means here. But then Nanda is so embarrassed and abashed that his friends in the holy life are making fun of him for this, that he decides just to go for it. And he restrains his senses, and he abides, like it says in the suttas, diligent, ardent, resolute, and reaches arhantship. And the Buddha dubs him as like foremost in sense restraint. So then Nanda goes to pay respects to the Buddha, and he's going to declare his attainment. And he says, Lord, I release you from that promise of the dove-footed nymphs. I have no longer have any desire for them. And the Buddha says, well, at the moment you attained arhantship, I was automatically released from that promise. And so so there's no need there. And so Nanda gets the foremost in sense restraint title. So like pulling one's mind out of the sign of the beautiful, which is so so powerful, the mind is like stuck in it. It's interesting too, because like when the mind is in a state of desire, then it's not peaceful, it's burning, it's agitated, but at the same time we're just unable to get out of it. That it's so convincing to follow it or try to fulfill that desire, to like move in that direction. It's so convincing, it's so strong. If it wasn't convincing, if it wasn't strong, then practice would be a lot easier. We wouldn't have, nobody would disrobe. People would stay with the training. It would just be onward and upward. But because the nature of the mind is it's caught in desire, and that's the whole round of rebirth, round of existence. So that sign of the beautiful is what keeps us, leads us along the road of suffering, keeps us on that long road. Kind of get this image of just like head down, just sort of like plodding along on this endless road, just leading nowhere. So it's bringing the mind out of the subhanimitta into the asubhanimitta. It's just incredibly important, both for monks and lay people. Anybody who wants to make like desire and lust become less, this is important. And it's the it's a kamatana, so it's something that we actually have to do. Like, we can't just talk about it a few times or read about it, but we actually have to, either during the sitting or walking meditation, or we can even do it while we're walking back to our kuti, just to consider it, rather than letting the mind just wander and be distracted. Just actually turning the mind, actually putting forth that effort to bring up the asubhanimitta. It's going to be different for everybody too. Like, sometimes it might be hair of the head, or it might be teeth or bones, or liver or intestines or skin. Like Tanajananan, Ajahn Chah assigned Ajahnanan to focus on skin in particular, saying that skin is that which deceives, that which deceives us. It's like the subhanimitta, the sign of the beautiful. It's always telling us like that skin is something which is like smooth and nice, and then but then when we look at it under a microscope, it's always oozing oils, and it has like sweat, and it starts to smell. So like, if we don't like rub soap on it, it has like it's like a very unpleasant smell. So we have to clean it and scrub it down constantly. So like, the inside of the body comes out through the skin. So it's like, that's giving rise to the asubhanimitta. So or like in the Tibetan tradition, they say like you're pulling a hair out of butter. So like pulling oneself out of the subhanimitta. And so when the mind starts to get interested in the asubhanimitta, then it gets fun. So then we don't have to, at first we might have to put forth a lot of effort to force the mind to not be distracted and to actually do the asubha practice. I think that's the main point, is like to actually do it. So we can like read about it a lot and talk about it a lot, but the point is to do it. Yeah, and then watching the mind get bright, watching the desire cool down, it's really great, really fun. But it's also something that it's specifically, you know, we have to, if we do a practice like this, it's something we do if we want to renounce the world as well. So we have to acknowledge that this is giving rise to a sense of weariness with samsara. And so the mind it's giving rise to nibbida, which is like a world weariness, weary with that long road of suffering, weary with the mind just deluding us over and over again. So we take on the practice, the precepts, and so on. So there's death contemplation, metta, asubha practice, and then we have like Buddha Nusati, or the practice of Buddho, which is taught in the Thai Forest tradition. Buddha Nusati. So is that like as a meditation technique, taught by the Kruba Ajahns, just breathing in but breathing out toe. And so you're doing this in conjunction with Anapanasati. Then this is a really great practice because we can do it during sitting meditation, walking meditation, or walking back to our kuti, or even when we're not talking during the work period, we can bring up buddho. So like sitting meditation, it's breathing in, but breathing out, toe, and then walking meditation, right foot steps, but left foot steps, toe, or walking back to your kuti, it can be like that. So it's like a samatha or just a calming meditation. But then like recollection of the Buddha gives rise to another type of nimitta. So we talked about like the subha nimitta and the asubha nimitta. This gives rise to what we call the pasati nimitta, which is the sign of inspiration or like a inspiring object for the mind. This is just incredibly important for keeping like an undercurrent of like well-being so that we're not going to drop below a certain threshold of ease and well-being. So even if we get distracted or don't meditate very much in a day, then that undercurrent of ease and well-being is there because of buddho, because we've been attending to the Buddha Nusati. So yeah, we can do this in so many different ways. We can just recollect the life story of the Buddha. We can think of just all the inspiring teachings, all of the things that the Buddha said or the example that he laid out. But we can also think of buddho as the one who knows, or just the knowing as the inner Buddha that everybody has. So it's like lifting the mind up, buoying the mind up, inspiring the mind. We can also think of like buddho as the awakened one. So it's like waking the mind up, brightening the mind. Or we can also give rise to a sense of inspiration by thinking that everything we have, the monastic form, just the genius of the Buddha formulating the Dhamma and Vinaya, the precepts, the Patimokkha, the robes that we wear, just the genius of the whole like almsgoing lifestyle, and that symbiotic circle of the monks and the lay people, as far as like the lay people supporting the monks' life, so with food and material support, and then the monks giving, like setting an example, being a heavenly messenger, being a sign of a religious seeker in society. So that kind of like upward spiral that the Buddha put in place. The Patimokkha, 227 precepts. So speaking of the Patimokkha, Tankantiko chanted his first Patimokkha today up at the Bhikkhu Commons. So that's also something which is inspiring, that people are developing. So like seeing people come up through the ranks, Anagarika, novice, Bhikkhu, and then as Bhikkhu is learning the Patimokkha. For people who don't know, the Patimokkha is chanted by memory. It's about 13,000 words in Pali and takes about 45 minutes, chanted extremely fast. And Tankantiko did that today. That's just to give an idea of the speed. It's sort of like I'll chant the first few lines of it. It's like, Uposita karana to pubina widang pupukichan katapang hoti tantana samajanasha tatapadi puchulancha asana panya panacha pani pari bojani upatapanancha. So kind of like that for 45 minutes. And I remember I did this as a demonstration at a Buddhist monastic conference in 2004 in Santa Cruz. And some of the traditions there hadn't ever heard Pali Patimokkha chanted. And it happened to be the Lunar Observance Day, the Uposatha Day, and so they had me do a truncated or shortened Patimokkha just as a demonstration. And there was monks and nuns from like Chinese tradition, Tibetan tradition, Korean, like Japanese Zen. And I did that, and then we asked for their impressions of it. And Reverend Kusala, who's a Western monk ordained in the Korean tradition, he said, it's kind of like a Dhamma attack. Like, I thought that was a good image. But yeah, the Buddha laying out the Dhamma Vinaya, the Patimokkha, just how incredible that is. So, Maranat Nusati, Metta Kamatana, Asubha Kamatana, Buddha Nusati. These are what we call the four protective meditations. It's something always to recollect, and which will, if we do them and keep them alive on a regular basis, then, and do them every day, like the Buddha recommended doing these every day, at least giving some thought, giving some mind to it every day, whether it's walking up to your kuti, going back to your dwelling place, or even just during sitting and walking meditation, just giving some thought to these four protective meditations in order to keep the mind on the path and to give an underlying sense of sukha, an underlying sense of ease and well-being, so that even if we go through the ups and downs of our path, the difficulties, whatever hindrances we may experience, then we won't drop below that threshold of ease and well-being, which is there because of those four protective meditations. So I'll just offer that. Take whatever is useful, make use of it. You can just leave whatever is not so useful. Sarva Dharma 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 Dharma